Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, we go to the Church of the Door Mission in the Holy Land, where local tradition holds that the Virgin Mary was assumed into heaven. The Christian faith is practiced elsewhere in the Middle East, the Maronite Church in Lebanon. And even when times are bad, how can we help others help themselves? Our supermarket cart or grocery basket may provide the answer. Each year, the Catholic Church remembers the Assumption of Our Lady into Heaven on August 15th. Different traditions hold that the Virgin Mary left this earthly life between 3 and 15 years after Christ's death and resurrection. She was assumed into heaven, accounts say, as she reposed in eternal sleep, either in Jerusalem or in Ephesus, in modern-day Turkey. While early accounts from the Holy Land reported that a Christian cult venerating Christ's mother had grown up around a place on Jerusalem's Mount Zion, just south of the old city walls. The spot, known from early times as Hagia Maria, continues to this day to be the site of prayers to Our Lady. Today, German-speaking Benedictine monks care for the Catholic Church of the Door Mission built there over the ruins of a series of early Christian shrines. Today, the monks serve the church, its guests, and pilgrims, and work for peace and reconciliation in the Holy Land. Well, I sat down with the noted scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas, who has led us on reflections on the holy sites in the land of Christ's birth, to ask him his thoughts on this Jerusalem shrine, celebrating the Virgin's death and assumption into heaven.
Yes and no. The church is in the care of German Benedictine monks. It's a beautiful, beautiful church. For people who watch EWTN and have seen Father Mitch Pacwa's rosary from the Holy Land, he does the mystery of the Assumption from the Church of the Door Mission. The Door Mission is the Eastern word for what we celebrate on August 15th. In the West, we refer to it as the Assumption. They refer to it as the Door Mission, which means Mary's going to sleep. And when you said it's the church that commemorates Mary's death and assumption, I said yes and no, because there's a divided opinion among theologians and a division of the theology which the church accepts. Some people say that Mary never died. And
that
so
she merely went to sleep.
Went to sleep, hence the word dormition. And it's fascinating if you read Pius XII's promulgation of the dogma of the Assumption, he allows for both theological opinions to coexist in the church. He says, when the course of her earthly life was finished, the Blessed Virgin Mary was assumed body and soul. Well, people who believe, as a matter of fact, that she died, physically died, say, yeah, when the course of her earthly life was finished, she died. But people who hold the alternative that she merely went to sleep and then was taken up into the glory of heaven can also be satisfied by Pius XII's formulation.
And there are people who also describe death as eternal sleep.
Sure, sure. And just in the, an important theological point that we see underscored in Pius XII's carefulness, the Church never pronounces on matters that are inessential and allows for a variety of theological explanations as long as that doesn't threaten a truth. And so no truth is sacrificed by holding either theological position. Now, this site, this Church of the Door Mission, is one of three or four places that claim that that's where Our Lady died. Some people say she died in Ephesus, some in Patmos. But at any rate, wherever it happened, wherever her passage into eternity occurred, this is one of the places that claims that. And I think a point to underscore here about this particular church is when Pius XII declared the dogma of the Assumption, promulgated the dogma of the Assumption, some people got it all backwards. They said, there's the Catholic Church making up new dogmas 19 centuries after something happened. Now they're making up a new thing that Catholics have to believe. Well, no. When a dogma is promulgated, it simply means that something that was always believed has now reached a sufficient level of theological reflection and maturity that the Church can say, this is now proposed for formal belief. Now, I mention this also because some evangelicals will say, well, there's no evidence in Scripture that Mary was assumed into heaven. Well, there is and there isn't. If you look at the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation, there are very, very strong clues that that's exactly what we're talking about, is her assumption. But more to the point, Pius didn't define in 1950 something brand new. This church of the Dormition goes back to the 4th century. Its existence, its physical existence, points to the church's perpetual belief in Mary's bodily assumption. And so this is what is commemorated by that physical site. Now, what does the dogma of the Assumption teach us? It teaches us, first of all, the goodness and the importance of the human body. Right now, there are two people in heaven, body and soul, our Lord, the God-man, and Our Lady, his mother and the mother of the church. In their persons, we have the new Adam and the new Eve, body and soul, which tell us this is the fulfillment of the entire human race. All of humanity, all of saved humanity, is in some sense already in heaven by virtue of the presence of Jesus and Mary. Secondly, Mary, as the first member of the church, as the mother of the church, is there precisely as the church in glory. She embodies the church in herself. And she, as a good mother, stands at the finish line, beckoning her children to come. And she's there to welcome us to the glory of her son's kingdom. She's also there, in a very important way, as a symbol of redeemed womanhood. She's the new Eve. Everything that was botched up in the first Eve was repaired in the second Eve. And Mary is a model of true feminism, Christian feminism, what a woman is called to be by virtue of her dignity as a daughter of God. And so all of this coalesces in this mystery of the Assumption. At the Second Vatican Council, there was a big discussion as to whether or not there ought to be a special document on the Blessed Virgin. And those that one would consider to be more traditional or conservative argue that there ought to be, and there needed to be, because we need to highlight the place of the Blessed Mother in the life of the Church. Other people said, no, 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 for this reason or that reason, we're not going to move in that direction, but let's include her in the document on the Church. And so the 8th chapter, the last chapter of Lumen Gentium, as a matter of fact, is a sustained theological and spiritual reflection on the place of Mary in the economy of salvation. And what does that do? It inserts her into the very heart of the Church. And as a result of that document, Paul VI declared Mary to be Mother of the Church. And in her, the poet Wordsworth says, is Mary is our tainted nature's solitary boast. Everything that could ever be good in a human person is in her. Cardinal Newman refers to her as the daughter of Eve unfallen. We tend to think of original sin as something, a black mark or a this or that. No, sin is an absence. And what's interesting to reflect on, Adam and Eve were created without sin. And so when Newman says that Mary is the daughter of Eve unfallen, by her immaculate conception, God's intervention at the very moment of her creation, her conception, he has preserved her, and he has made her very much what Eve herself was. Sometimes people say, well, if Mary was conceived without sin, no wonder she didn't sin, and she couldn't sin. No, no, she could sin. She could have sinned. Eve was conceived, was created without sin. but she sinned. Adam was created without sin, and he sinned. No, it's a question that her entire orientation from the moment of her conception was a response to the grace that was given to her. And therefore, she stands again at the finish line as a model, but also as an intercessor, as a mother, bidding us to follow her example and giving us confidence that her intercession, as a matter of fact, will bring us safely home.
Father Peter Stravinskas is a noted Catholic scholar and author and editor of The Catholic Response. One of the oldest Catholic communities in the Middle East, the Maronite Church, has been loyal to the Pope here in Rome since the 4th century. Throughout the ensuing centuries, Maronites have had to take refuge from waves of persecution in the northern mountains of Lebanon. Today, they're found all over the world, many having fled war at home. Well, I sat down with Maronite Father Jean Mohana, head of Vatican Radio's Arab department, who told me more about this Eastern Rite Catholic Church.
The Maronite Church belongs to the Syrian Antiochian Apostolic Church.
Way back, centuries ago, back in the 4th century, they spoke Aramaic, didn't they? Which, of course, was the language of Christ.
Yes, of course. But it remains till the beginning of the 17th century only, especially in the north of Lebanon.
But Aramaic was used.
It was used only during the liturgy, the masses, and some people studied. It was taught in the clerical schools for the people also, but for liturgical use only.
How does the Eastern Rite liturgy and the ceremonies, how do they differ from the Roman Catholic liturgies? I've been to a wedding. I've been to a Maronite baptism. My own baby girl was baptized by the Maronite priest in the church here in Rome. And there are some beautiful ceremonies, which are different from the ones that we Roman Catholics celebrate in the Mass.
Yes, of course. Each Eastern church has its own characteristics, but the sacraments are the same. It's like you are American, I'm Lebanese. Everybody has his language, culture back. So it's an expression, but the same faith, the same sacraments expressed in different ways. Mm.
For example, in the wedding ceremony, the couple is given a crown to wear.
Yes, a crown. That means it's like they are groom and bride. That means like the wedding between the church and Christ. And that's why it's like a queen and a king in the church, and that means the blessing of God, like in the Genesis, when God said to Adam, you dominate all the creatures, it's up to you. That means we are gods in the view of God also, but we're still a human being. Everyone, every single man and woman must work to be like God, to achieve sanctity, holiness, that everyone is called to.
In 1992, the Maronite Church revised its liturgy and the way its priests dress to reflect its ancient Eastern roots. Since then, you'll find incense and candles often used, among other symbols, to express the faith.
It's used much, but also it's like in the psalm, let my prayer be elevated to you, God, like incense. Transports you, if I can use this verb. It's transport everyone from earth to heaven.
And I remember also when we were baptizing my little girl, we were all given a candle and we made a procession around the church with the baby.
At the end.
Yes.
Yes. That means now each baptized in Christ is becoming a light, like Jesus told us. Everyone must be the light of Christ. And the newborn or new baptized, it's also becoming with the whole family, Christian family, lights.
And the fact that we were asked to make a procession around the
church. It's a light not only where I'm sitting, light wherever I go, wherever I work, wherever I move, I'm light. I must enlight the others.
And the very fact that we're making a circle around the inside of the church is also very symbolic.
It's this procession inside the church. it's very important in the Maronite Church, but also in the other Eastern churches. That means the church is a family with Jesus Christ, is moving all the time under his blessings and the meaning of evangelizing. And everything is done under his blessings, but doesn't mean it's a passive church. It's a church in movement. It reveals our roots. It's a transmission across centuries and millenaries.
Maronite Father Jean Muhana, head of Vatican Radio's Arab Department. From coffee, tea, chocolate, and rice to candles, gifts, and clothing, they're the kind of products offered by stores and organizations part of the Fair Trade Movement, a global push to give farmers and local producers their fair share of the prices of the items we buy. More and more fair trade conscious shops have popped up in big cities and towns across the globe, but still, fair trade has not become a common household term. Well, I sat down with the justice and peace promoters for the Dominican Order, Sister Toni Harris, and for the Marist Fathers, Father Paul Frechet, to talk about why fair trade should matter to any of us. But first, I asked Sister Toni how she explains fair trade to those curious to know more about it.
Fair trade is a term that's become fairly more well-known, I think, since the late 80s. And it describes an effort to assure that the people who produce goods are given a fair price for their goods and some kind of a stable price for their goods. For example, people who produce coffee are often victims of the market that can be controlled by forces far removed from their countries. But fair trade organizations and fair trade systems have tried to create connections between local producers and ways of distributing their products so that they are not the ones who in the cycle of distribution are the people who actually receive the least for the product. So whether it's actual products like coffee and tea, which are some of the more popular, or even products that are more craft or artisan kind of products, textile products, the effort is to move the product right to the point of distribution or sale and remove some of the steps in between that both take away from the producer and also basically, as I said, because of the market, make the prices that they might get for their products more unstable.
Right. Well, many of the fair trade products that we see in some of the small shops and so on here in Rome are coming from Africa, they're coming from Asia, they're coming from South America. What sort of products are these that we're seeing? You said artisan products, coffee, tea, but what might be some other products?
Well, there'd be chocolate, cocoa, like from Ghana, from Africa. There'd be tea from India, there's honey, there's juices, there's wines. And these prices with these items I just mentioned are pretty comparative. The prices have been coming down a little bit. But where the fair trade products are not comparative would be in jams and jellies. The multinationals still have a
monopoly on
yes.
that. But I was going to ask you, many people do look at the fair trade products almost as a luxury product, and they say, oh boy, these prices are a little bit out of my range. I mean, is that always the case, though?
Yes and no. Yes, with the jams and jellies, but with the coffees and teas, the prices have become a bit comparative now. So much so that even people like Nestle's and Starbucks coffee are doing maybe 10% of their coffee from the fair trade industry. And we'd like to see that go up.
In these times of global economic crisis, why should I be willing to pay a bit more? Why should I want to pay more?
Well, I think as a commitment to solidarity in the world, particularly those of us who are in the Christian faith tradition with some belief that the other people in the world are, in fact, our sisters and brothers, our decisions about the food we eat, the clothes we wear, All of the things we purchase, we know more and more have an impact on the wider global community. So what we've pointed out is that a lot of times religious communities or families designate some of their family income, even in hard times, for charity. And we could encourage people and encourage organizations to see the little extra they might have to pay for some of these products as part of that portion of their income that they're willing to spend for charity or for other kinds of activities that they might contribute to. So it's a little bit more, but it has implications, I think, not only fair trade, but even the stores and the markets that we purchase other things from. You know, those decisions are increasingly more significant for producers everywhere.
Now, I know that you are encouraging other religious orders, especially here in Rome, to participate.
We're saying this is an option. Many of our houses have a 5% budget item for charity, and we're suggesting that this is a good option for charity.
Why is it important that these big religious communities participate in a project like this?
It's important that religious communities, religious houses, consider this as a possible option because there are, in many of these houses, large communities, and so there are a lot of large purchases that someone's benefiting from. So if communities are able to redirect even a portion of their purchasing power, their economic power, to support fair trade, it could have a big impact. And hopefully this might become a permanent change for communities in terms of the way they purchase some products. And as Father Paul mentioned, there are food products, but religious communities also have jubilees and special celebrations, and considering getting fair trade craft or art pieces for those kinds of events is another way to support the other part of fair trade products.
And then just to build on that, religious do have economic power. I think we maybe take it for granted. But when you look at our ministries, even looking out into the world, our ministries of schools and parishes and hospitals, these are other opportunities. But that's if the leadership accepts the idea and gives the witness value as well.
So in other words, it's putting your money where your mouth is.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Exactly. And we just heard this one diocese in Ireland. I want to make sure I pronounce it right. Arda and Clonmacnoise just made the decision to become fair trade, the whole diocese. So there you've got parishes and schools. Also, Cadbury Daily Milk, which is
biggest chocolate producer in Ireland.
In Ireland, and the favorite chocolate bar in Ireland. So it's,
and the UK.
And the UK as well.
All of the UK.
Yes, yes. And they have decided to go fair trade, particularly with the farmers in Ghana, because the cocoa beans there are some of the best tasting in the world. So it's a good deal all around for them. But it's going to be a tremendous effect for the farmers in Ghana.
So you're saying that actually businesses themselves can get involved in fair trade.
Exactly.
What kind of a difference does this make to the farmer on the ground, the farmer in Africa, the producer in South America?
Well, I think that the press release that came out connected with Cadbury's decision to move to fair trade chocolate, the closing paragraph, if I can share that, it says Cadbury will also be sourcing cocoa from Kwapaku Koku, one of the first cooperative groups to be fair trade certified, with over 40,000 registered cocoa farmers from across Ghana. Although they are currently only selling 3% of their cocoa as fair trade, they have been able to implement community projects like building primary school classrooms, constructing wells, investing in corn mills. Now that Kwapaku Koku will have the opportunity to sell cocoa to Cadbury on fair trade terms, this will increase their fair trade premiums and therefore the range of farmer support and community development programs they can implement. So this kind of guaranteed stable income in a small community has very significant impact for the quality of life for the people there, as related to schools, clinics, wells, you know, just basic necessities that people have.
What does fair trade mean to the big mass producers and the protectionist policies of countries around the world that say, you know, I want to put a limit to all the cocoa that's coming from one country or the rice that's coming or the wheat because I've got my own quotas within my own country? How does fair trade affect all that?
Well, one way of looking at it is, I'll tell this through a story. There was a Franciscan friar in Ireland who organized a group of about 10 people in the business world, in the education world. It was in a town. And they studied the issue of fair trade and saw that there's benefit to it all around. And over a year, they met and they approached the supermarkets saying that we will buy this item if you stock it. And so it became mainstreamed. Now, here in Rome, these shops are on side streets, and it'll take quite a while, I think, to get it mainstreamed at the supermarket. But in Ireland, it happened. And children began encouraging their parents to buy this type of cereal or this type of chocolate bar.
And I've been to the Holy Land where I've met Christian farmers who've formed a cooperative, and the local parish priest in a little town called Taibe convinced in France a whole chain of supermarkets to buy their olive oil as part of this fair trade agreement, and people are buying it.
Interesting, one of the fair trade shops here in Rome is in the parish center of the parish of Transfigurazione in Monteverde Nuova. The parish staff there values this, and so it's right on church property. You go to Mass, and then afterwards, you can get your coffee or tea or chocolate for the week. There are young adults that are running the shop. Some of them have been to Ghana to visit some of these sites.
So it sounds like it's an initiative that even local parishes can adopt.
Exactly.
One last question. Is there any way that fair trade could affect relations between countries on a global level? Is it such a small initiative that it can't really make a difference?
Well, one of the things that I think about in relation to a question like that is that if, in fact, economic markets are more stable for people in countries that we call developing, whether that's a fair term or not, but developing countries where people are struggling to basically feed themselves and take care of their families. One of the effects, I think, that eases some tensions is that I believe that most people really want to stay in their countries of origin and work and live and raise their families. They want to be where their roots are, where their families are, where their cultures are respected and active. And if
so, you're saying that it will affect immigration.
It could affect immigration if people, in fact, as we were reading about these folks in Ghana now who can actually work and have some kind of stable income. Those are implications, I think, for stabilizing economies in the world and reducing some of the tension that the mass movement for immigration of people who basically want to feed themselves and their families, and so they go looking for a better life, like many of our ancestors did as well.
And a very warm thanks there to Dominican Sister Toni Harris and Marist Father Paul Frechet.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.